Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. I'm speaking today with John Robert Marlowe. John Marlowe is the author of the new novel Nano, which was just released in hardcover from St. Martin's Press, selected as Book of the Month by the World Transhumanist Association, and was recently honored as the Nanotechnology Now Editor's Choice Award. Welcome, John.
Hello.
So this is a techno thriller set in the near future, but with quite revolutionary sci-fi kind of consequences for humanity and the world. How did you come to want to write a book about nanotechnology?
I've been a journalist for 14 years, covering usually scientific and medical topics, making sometimes complex topics understandable to a general audience, translating geek speak into English, basically, for people who would be interested in or could benefit from these technologies and advances, but wouldn't find out about them because they don't read the technical journals. And I became intensely interested in nanotechnology, particularly after reading Eric Drexler's Engines of Creation. And I thought, this is something that is going to affect every person on the planet one way or another, and sooner or later it's going to be the only issue that matters, and people need to know about this. So I thought the best way to do that, given my abilities, would be to put it into a novel and present the possibilities, good and bad, of nanotechnology in a dramatic and exciting format.
Well, it's very interesting to read your novel because you weigh in very clearly on the side of the technical plausibility. You know, it's not just a novel. There's also a technical appendix about the different kinds of research that you're referencing and some of the feasibility options that you want to promote. And you're clearly weighing in on the option of molecular manufacturing or nanorobotics being a possibility. And this is, of course, a hotly debated topic right now in the field of nanotechnology, because all the guys who are getting all the big bucks are the ones doing nanomaterials research, and they don't want any money to go towards molecular manufacturing because it'll take money away from them, and also it'll scare the horses because of things like you're talking about in this book. So how did you come out on the side of thinking that molecular manufacturing was feasible? Was Eric Drexler the convincing factor, or are there other considerations for you?
And by molecular manufacturing, do you mean essentially nanites?
Nanites, yeah. Nanorobotic, self-reproducing nanorobotics.
Oh, well, I think nanosystems makes it pretty clear that it's a possibility, which is a technical treatise by Drexler. It seems that the people who are genuinely interested in advancing the technology rather than just making a quick profit off it are in general agreement that this is possible, and because it's possible, it's an eventuality. Creating these devices will enable us to do everything that the smaller steps will enable us to do, the smaller commercial steps that are being taken. It's the holy grail, it's been called, of nanotechnology. If you can create these devices, they will be able to do anything that the laws of physics allow. And that's where we want to be. I don't want to screw around with the small steps. I want to take the big leap. And I think most people who are genuinely interested in advancing the field do.
Now, your book talks about self-reproducing nanotechnology from the kind of gray goose scenario, self-reproducing nanites, which can quite explosively deconstruct materials and could potentially gobble up the whole planet. And a lot of people in the nanotech field have poo-pooed this particular option because they argue things like the heat that would be produced in this kind of explosive growth of nanotech would boil them themselves, and so they wouldn't be able to grow, and so on and so forth. Are you weighing in on that technical question, or are you just assuming that eventually this kind of nano weapon or nano explosive accidental release of nanotech will be possible?
Well, it could be accidental or deliberate, depending on who's handling the technology. The expansion rate is well within the range specified by Robert Freitas in his paper on global
ecophagy.
Global ecophagy.
That's okay. A great title. Biovorous ecophagy.
Yeah, I always trip over that title. But this was actually the subject of debate recently in February or March on Sci-Nanotech and the CRN blog, what the maximum possible swarm expansion rate was. And it turns out that though most people believe Freitas' paper is a statement of maximum expansion rates, he gives a figure of something like 20 days for the destruction of the biosphere. He clearly says in the paper that much faster progress is possible and that an accident or a malicious act could result in the destruction of the biosphere in 2.5 days, allowing for the possibility of progress orders of magnitude swifter than that.
Now, given that you're a science journalist, that you've been paying attention to this field, what's your guess as to the time frame that we're talking about for the actual creation of nanites or some kind of self-reproducing nanorobotics?
Well, one of the big things it depends on is how much money is thrown at it by which parties. Right now, Washington is moving the other way, largely because of Smalley, who seems to feel that if people see the true potential downside of this technology, that they're going to start screaming at Congress, and Congress is going to back off on the funding. But I'm not sure that's true. I think people should see both sides of the issue, the benefits and the dangers. Otherwise, they're not going to take enough care to prevent the dangers from happening. Time frame, I've heard people in NASA say 5 years. I've heard them say 50 years, probably in our lifetime.
But your book is very clear that there's two tracks here. There's the public, civilian, open sourced research, which is accessible to all of us. And then there's the military research. And military research is probably not poo-pooing this idea and taking it a lot more seriously than the NSF is, wouldn't you imagine?
I would certainly hope so. Is there a Nano Manhattan Project? We don't know. At the time of the Manhattan Project, a lot of top-level scientists just vanished from their universities, and people who were in the know knew that all these people had disappeared and knew that something like this was going on somewhere. Today, that wouldn't be necessary because we can communicate through the Internet or through the military's version of the Internet. So people could actually be involved, top-level scientists, in such a project and never leave their positions. Other people wouldn't notice that they had all gone somewhere else.
I'm speaking with John Robert Marlowe. He's the author of the novel Nano, which is a techno-thriller about the emergence of molecular manufacturing or self-reproducing nanobots. And these technologies having world-changing consequences, some of which are very, very scary and some of which are very, very cool. But you also talk about them in the context of the current military apparatus, and one of them is Echelon. Can you tell us a little bit more about Echelon?
Echelon is basically a worldwide surveillance network set up by the National Security Agency, which monitors, estimates vary, 85 to 95% of the world's electronic communications. If you pick up a phone and speak into it, Echelon hears it. If you send a fax or an email, Echelon reads it. Basically, all electronic communications are potentially interceptable and recordable by Echelon.
And you project that Echelon would give an enormous totalitarian control to someone who wanted to use it in a malicious purpose, and that the nanotechnology and other kinds of technologies might give someone access to that.
Well, after I turned the manuscript into the publisher, Echelon actually made headlines throughout Europe as some European governments began accusing the United States of using it to spy on European corporations to benefit United States corporations.
And we've also got evidence now that the U.S. and Brits were spying on Kofi Annan's office during the Iraq War crisis. We may be using some of these tools in ways that we shouldn't. Of course, we screwed up our first Iraq nuclear weapons of mass destruction surveillance program by spying on it. So, yeah, spying, the history of spying. And yet we seem to produce no intelligence through our spy networks. It's quite ironic.
Have they found those yet?
Yeah, exactly. Now, you talk in the book about the super swarm option, and you contrast it with Eric Drexler's option of a network of global satellites. Can you talk about these two options, and then contrast it also, I would like, if you can, with Bob Freitas's work, where he talks about the need for a global surveillance network to make sure that we don't have accidental releases of nanotechnology or terrorist uses of nanotech?
Well, the superswarm option picks up on Drexler's idea of active shields and applies it to nanotechnology. An active shield is basically a system that cannot be used for offensive purposes but can be used for defense. One of the permutations that he proposed in Engines of Creation was a system of orbital weapons platforms, which would be independently controlled. It would not be under the control of any nation. It would make its own decisions. It would detect a missile launch, for example, destroy the missiles, perhaps then destroy the site of the missile launch to prevent large-scale aggression. The super swarm option extends this to nanotechnology. The most obvious problem with a rogue nanoswarm, out-of-control microscopic nanodevices which destroy everything in their path to make more copies of themselves, is that once a swarm reaches a critical threshold, it has the capability to expand faster than anything you can use to stop it. Once the swarm's expansion rate passes point X, it can't be stopped. Worse, your chances of getting a countermeasure on target before point X is reached, to say the least, are not good, unless you're willing and able to deliver, say, a nuclear warhead to the target within minutes of the time the accident or attack begins. The result could be the destruction of every living thing on the planet in a matter of hours to days. So, basically, once this thing gets a head start, you can't beat it, unless your countermeasure is already there when the event begins. The superswarm, as proposed, is an invisible carpet of nanites which would cover the entire Earth. Its only purpose would be to detect dangerous events like out-of-control nanite swarms and destroy them immediately, because the superswarm is everywhere at once, has superior numbers, and would attack any rogue swarm immediately from all directions. It would be impossible to defeat. No rogue swarm could survive it. The downside, of course, is that if the superswarm somehow went rogue itself, we'd all disappear in seconds. Is the benefit worth the risk? I don't know. It's just a proposal. I'm floating it for further discussion. The entire superswarm paper can be found as the appendix to the nano novel or at johnrobertmarlow.com, which also has a link to the Nanotechnology Now interview on the topic.
It strikes me as quite similar to the Diamond Age, which has no specific proposals, but just projects a future in which hostile nanotechnology is floating around us all the time. And as a consequence, we've all developed as communities and public health departments and our own personal biosystems have a kind of countermeasures that are always active. And some people don't have as good of countermeasures as others, and they have allergic reactions to all these swarms of nano dust that are around them all the time. And you know, what you kind of project is that the entire world would have to be protected by a pervasive and an invasive system of nano surveillance.
It's one possible option. It may not be the best, but it's the only thing that I came up with that would have a possibility of stopping any nano event at any point on the globe immediately.
Yeah, that's a scary option. And I think your book has as much a possibility to scare people, and probably more possibility to scare people than something like Michael Crichton's Prey, which Crichton puts nanotech in the scary monsters category. You know, that you get a bunch of these nanites reproducing and you have to whack them just like you would Frankenstein. And doesn't at all project a global political or social response that would be required to actually deal with these new technologies.
Well, I like Crichton, particularly Jurassic Park and Lost World. Prey was similar to those in that it dealt with a small group of people in an isolated location. Nano, which I actually delivered to my publisher a little while before Prey came out, is more wide-ranging. I wanted to explore the effect, good and bad, that nanotech could have on the world at large, rather than confine the story to one location. I also wanted to raise the stakes with Nano and say, if this tech goes wrong in a big way, by accident or design, nothing on this planet will survive, so we need to be careful as we develop it, which is what you mentioned. Topics covered in Nano go beyond that into AI, transhumanism, singularity, everything I could think of that is involved with this technology that I could get into the novel.
Well, let's mention singularity. The idea of a rapid change in social conditions brought about by AI and or nano or and or genetic engineering of some kind. You clearly have that happening in this book, that the advent of this self-reproducing nanobots creates an entirely new world political order and allows us all to transcend the human condition. But it comes at the cost of one guy getting to control everything. is that the trade-off, you think, that you reference Hazel Henderson's idea that there's an inherently totalitarian dynamic in the complexification of technology, which I would dispute in that our societies have become increasingly democratic as they've become more technological.
On the other hand, the potential to abuse that technology to make them less democratic is always there. And if you have nanotechnology, it doesn't have to be a nation that develops this. as Bill Joy pointed out, in Why the Future Doesn't Need Us in Wired, an individual could develop this. Given sufficient funds, an individual may develop this. We don't know. To get back to the singularity, which you had mentioned, I think the singularity most people think of is the one proposed by Werner Vinge, who actually gave me a quote to put on the back cover of Nano.
Yeah, very nice quote.
The Matrix. I thought that was very cool. His observation is that because the pace of technological change continues to increase drastically, at some point in the not-too-distant future, we're going to reach a point of critical mass, a single instant at which the pace of technological change outstrips the ability of the human mind to comprehend, keep up with, or manage. That point, that event, is the singularity. If it hasn't occurred by the time nanotech arrives, I think the development of nanotech will trigger it. What happens after that, it's impossible to know. If we fail to develop AI or upgrade ourselves in time to deal with it, we're not likely to survive it. Will it be one person who upgrades himself to deal with it? We don't know. We don't know who's going to develop nanotech or take it to the limit. So we can't really say at this point.
It's interesting. I mean, a lot of the debates within the transhumanist community are political debates between people of more left-wing persuasions and people of more libertarian persuasions. But latent behind all of those, there's also a set of fissures over which technologies we think are going to whack humanity upside the head first. And there are nano partisans, and there are AI partisans, and there are genetics partisans. And, you know, all of those scenarios have quite different consequences. They may all have, profound risks and benefits that will amount to the same thing. But you know, you're in this case, you're suggesting that before we ever have self-reproducing AI or self-reproducing or some kind of somatic genetic engineering, which would give us immortality, we would have this nanobot phase. And again, is that something, are you just projecting this scenario as this might happen, or is that something that you feel in your gut, you know, that nano is probably more likely to happen than these other things?
Well, certainly the amount of money that's being thrown at nano now is increasing dramatically. According to the National Science Foundation, between 1997 and mid-2003, international government spending on nanotech had increased by 700%. This was before the recent $5 billion 21st century Nanotechnology Research and Development Act in the United States. I think that nanotech will make the other things possible, certainly instant genetic engineering. And AI, it will enable that. Whether it will necessarily mean that we can immediately achieve AI is another question.
And you do have some transhuman characters in the book, the protagonists, the Jen and John? Is Jen and Mark. No, who's the male protagonist?
Jen and John Merrick.
Jen and John. They both get transformed by nano-replicator cellular repair devices that allow them to go through literally hell and back. Obviously, that's something that's part of the good stuff that comes out of this.
Well, if I'm going to create a situation where humans can't survive, I have to create post-humans to survive it.
Right. Well, I think that's one of the things that, again, depending on where you come from on the ideological spectrum, reading this novel, you get to that point where they become so totally transformed that they actually can survive an apocalyptic scenario like that. And you think, now, is that still human? And I read this and I don't see that as a challenge at all. I mean, I think your protagonists still consider themselves human. They don't suddenly feel that they've left behind the human race. I mean, have you given that any thought, that once people transform themselves with nanotechnology the way that you describe here, will there be a fissure between the transformed and the untransformed?
Well, there's a discussion which takes place early in the nano novel regarding transhumanism, and some people in the community seem to act as basically techno-cheerleaders. They want the technology, they want to transform themselves, but they're not giving a great deal of thought to what they're going to be transformed into. We basically define what is human, and if we become something else, then that will also be human, even though at the moment we call it post-human. I think a good deal of thought needs to be given to where we want to go. We don't just take the technology and use it because it's possible. We have to make sure that where it's taking us is a place that we value, some place we want to be. We don't want to transform ourselves, become post-human, and then not even realize that life isn't worth living, because none of the values we held dear before, we even comprehend anymore. We don't know what's going to happen, and there is likely to be a schism between the transformed and the people who perhaps choose to stay behind. And those who advance are going to say, well, those others just don't understand. But who's to make the judgment as to where our values have gone? Right now, we value things like beauty. We value art. Will that be true of post-humans? We don't know. It might depend upon the mechanism of transformation. If you've got a computer element mixed with a human brain, which one is going to dominate? We don't know. It's impossible to say. And once you've taken that step, you may not be able to step back if you don't like where you are.
Mm. Excellent. I'm speaking with John Robert Marlow. He's the author of the new novel, Nano. I'm Dr. J. This is Change Surfer Radio. John Marlow's novel is the book of the month here at the World Transhumanist Association website. I say here because I'm the webmaster there. And was recently honored by the Nanotechnology Now Editor's Choice Award, and definitely portrays a lot of the scenarios that the people in the nano and transhumanist communities are concerned about and are trying to think about. Again, one of the scenarios that you have there is that this technology will empower the creators of technology. It reminds me of a study that was done of computer implementation in businesses. And there had been a theory in the 70s and 80s that computer technology would democratize power within businesses and make them more horizontal and less vertical in their organizational structure. And other theorists had said, well, it would just give more power to the centralize everything and give more power to the CEO to control things from their office. And what most of this research had found up into the early 90s, at least, was that the people that benefited most consistently were the computer engineers, because they were the only ones who really knew what was going on, and they were making a lot of critical design decisions which determined how everything else worked. Now, in this particular case, you're revolutionary scientist, hero, god, man, emperor,
post-human,
functions as a world government, a benevolent world government. But as you know from talking to me before, I have a more optimistic or sanguine or I'm more interested in proposing, at least, that the UN and other kinds of global governance be strengthened and democratized and made a legitimate vehicle for the control of these kinds of apocalyptic technologies. Was that just not a sexy enough option to make into a novel, or was that something you just didn't think was at all possible?
Well, something like that would be the ideal situation, where you have an international cooperative agreement to safely proceed with nanotechnology and technologies of similar consequences. In the scenario presented in the novel, you've got nanotechnology just being created. This is a molecular nanotechnology, a full-spectrum nanotechnology, and governments are reacting as they have in the past with other technologies. They want it first. They don't want anyone else to have it because it will give them more power, the situation we had with the atomic bomb. So the hero sees himself as out of options. He's got people trying to kill him, and what he wants to do is jump ahead of the other side, the bad guys. And the only way he sees to do that is to become something more than human, to use this technology on himself so he's bright enough to figure out a way to beat these guys and get the world to the place where it should be. In his opinion, granted, if we had an evil person doing this, there would be no way to stop him. It'd be a nightmare scenario, much the same as an evilly motivated government running the technology.
Well, are you thinking about a sequel? I mean, this conclusion reminded me of Dune, because here you have the God Emperor, you know, being set up, and that would be a great conclusion or a great sequel to say, well, you know, how pissed off do people get at having suddenly woken up in this guy's universe, and what countermeasures will be taken under that kind of scenario to change the world within those constraints? Are you thinking about a sequel at all?
Yeah, I was thinking about a sequel when I was writing it.
Okay, good.
If this book becomes popular enough, the sequel will happen. One of the great challenges, I thought, was once you've set up this character as you call him a god emperor, how do you challenge that?
Yeah.
What would be a threat?
Exactly.
So that was the toughest thing to think of. But I thought of that, although I can't tell you what it is.
Okay. Well, you're working on a screenplay also, I understand, and there may be a movie coming?
Well, I hope there will be a movie. The first act of the screenplay is on the website at johnrobertmarlow.com. Four-time Oscar-nominated director Lawrence Kasdan, who wrote things like The Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi, Raiders of the Lost Ark, among others, called the screenplay hugely commercial. he's one of the great filmmakers, and I adore his work. Unfortunately, negotiations there fell through over book rights, so the movie isn't happening quite yet. I would like to see it happen, and certainly if there are any producers with large budgets out there listening, feel free to take a look.
Call me, too. Don't just call John.
Business consultant.
We at the summer Transvision conference that we're holding in Toronto, one of the things we're trying to do with this conference is bring together a number of science fiction writers who address transhumanist themes. Greg Bear and Ken McLeod are both honorary vice chairs of the WTA, for instance. And we want to kind of engage them around a discussion about how science fiction has changed in the portrayal of transhumanist technologies and options, from using them as simply the horrific MacGuffin to trying to normalize them, to try to talk about, okay, given that we're going to have human enhancement, what kind of social questions, what kind of social options will evolve out of that, you know, both the positive and the negative, you know, not just being purely dystopian, not being purely utopian, and trying to get them beyond this, you know, using it always as the negative images and stereotypes. Because, you know, I can't tell you how many times in these debates you get hammered with Brave New World, 1984, Frankenstein. You know, it's like, come on. In Leon Cass, the president's bioethics advisor, you know, he assigned Hawthorne, a science fiction story by Hawthorne, as the very first reading for the Bioethics Commission. And the reader that they put out had a series of science fiction-y themed things, but all from, like, you know, before the 1950s. And it's like, the problem with the bioethics debate right now is that they're all reading the wrong science fiction. They need to read things like Bruce Sterling and, you know, William Gibson and people like yourself.
What I don't understand about Hollywood, for example, is when they do a movie so far, something like this, Bicentennial Man, for example, they'll take the technology, the prospect of immortality, say, and show how wonderful it could be, and then they have the character at the end back away from it. I see this repeatedly in the movies, and I find it kind of disturbing. I want to take the next step. I want to show characters taking the next step, not going to the edge, peering over, and coming back.
Right.
I want to see them jumping off.
Right. Well, Brian Stableford's Immortality series, where he talks about the slow evolution of life extension technologies and how they improved and how the society adapted around different phases of them. And one of my favorite characters in his novels is the guy who, it's the Fountains of Immortality, I think is the novel, but at any rate, the guy, he knows that he's going to live for at least 1,000 years, and so he decides that he's going to write the definitive encyclopedic history of death, and he takes 50 years to write each volume. You know? So, you know, those are the kind of life plans that people will develop when they have the kind of time, and the life plans that you can't currently have.
Well, no, I couldn't possibly spend more than 200 years on that.
Yeah, right, exactly. John, it's been a pleasure talking to you. John Robert Marlowe is the author of the new novel Nano, released in hardcover by St. Martin's Press, and you can find him at johnrobertmarlowe.com, and he has a full spectrum website there that leads you to all kinds of resources about nanotechnology. Really, thank you for joining us today, John.
Well, thank you for having me here.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.